This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. Every week I bring you stories on a theme. Today the theme that links our stories are blending. So much blending goes on in our lives. And the three pieces in this program are about blending of people, places, food, and sexuality. The feature piece comes from Dr. Lisa Diamond. She's the psychologist who's learned that our sexuality might not be as rigidly defined as had been thought. Some women have a fluidity about their sexual orientation, an ability to be with male or female partners. Lisa's ideas are getting attention. Her insights have been featured in the New York Times, and she's appeared on Oprah. Lisa Diamond shares her discoveries about sexuality on today's program, which is called Mix It Up. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. The theme of today's show is Mix It Up. Installment number one. Rachel Dolezal is a human rights activist. She came to advocacy in human rights after many moves, from Montana to Colorado to South Africa to Mississippi, Washington, D.C., and to Idaho, where her experiences as a person with a blended ethnic and racial identity showed her the need to speak out.
I was born in Montana, Northwest Montana, and my folks lived in a teepee initially when they were married. And our family covers, you know, ethnically quite a span of diversity in terms of African American, Haitian, German, Czech, Swedish, Lakota Sioux, Cherokee, Jewish, and Arabic ancestry.
Okay, wait now. I am from a mixed up, generically, genetically mongrel American background. But Rachel makes my Irish, German, British, and who knows what else, European, Slavic background seem just plain vanilla. So before we go on, let's hear that again from Rachel Dolezal.
African American, Haitian, German, Czech, Swedish, Lakota Sioux, Cherokee, Jewish, and Arabic. And so there's a lot of identity to choose from in terms of primary, secondary, tertiary, whatever. And so that kind of shapes or, you know, it's a background piece of who I am and some reasons for what I do and also why certain forms of retaliation are understandable or at least, you know, justifiable within the hate ideology. Our family moved from Montana to Colorado to South Africa, Western Cape region, and we're, you know, South Africa 5 years. I went to undergrad school in Jackson, Mississippi, and spent some time reconnecting with my family there, extended family. My grandpa was part of the civil rights movement and really terrible abuses during the civil rights movement in terms of Uncle Clyde, his brother getting shot by white police officers, dying in his arms, grandpa being beat up and forks jammed up his nose and beat beyond recognition by white police officers for marching and the sit-ins. And so some of that, you know, just being in Mississippi and feeling that made me, it compelled me to activism from freshman in college on, and really I had started already in high school. Had an internship in D.C. during the Clinton years. We won't talk about that. it was during the Monica Lewinsky thing, so it was just all very, it's like, no, nothing happened. It was an internship that actually was very rigorous. So Mississippi connected me with my black side and really civil rights issues and passion for justice as far as race issues. And in Mississippi, if you've lived there as a multicultural person, and it's kind of a black and white dichotomy, you know, you have to take a side. And so I was in the Black Student Association, and we raised the percentages of minority students at Bellhaven College from 5% as a freshman I started to 15% when I left. And, you know, we had lots of activism that came out of that. And I, by the way, also had a tutoring program, black history and math and different subjects. I tutored for 25 kids ages 5 to 12 in Mississippi, in the hood, you know, to keep kids safe when moms had to work out and kids were hanging out after school. And so I ran a tutoring program amidst drive-by shootings and very interesting environment as far as it connects with some of the family too that's in Southside Chicago in 100s block right now. And one of my little brothers who's still in high school is going to be, I'm going to be adopting him this summer because of domestic violence and other situations there. And so, which is going to rock the boat in the family. Another issue. So Mississippi to Washington, D.C. to Howard University. And that was, you know, going to Mecca and feeling like, okay, I'm here, I can be empowered. And there's a lot of discrimination within minority groups and from one minority group to another minority group. And those of us who connect with minority groups or you know, have these blended identities know this. And thinking I could just relax, be at home, to some extent, yes, to some extent, no. Got my full tuition scholarship jerked the second year because I had white relatives who probably had money who could probably, you know, even though I was, you know, summa cum laude and all these things. Anyway, so I had to sue Howard. Eventually got my scholarship back. And so it's just been a long journey of human rights issues. So connecting, you know, geographically, then D.C. to Idaho, big circle, back to the Northwest, the different identities, and then the different human rights issues that I've interfaced with include, of course, racism and gender discrimination, also age discrimination and sexual assault and rape and domestic violence and, you know, just a lot of different issues that have kind of woven themselves into my life. And navigating those has helped me to understand what human rights is and why it's so important for everybody to kind of step up and engage and for us to kind of join hands and be a community together moving forward and the power of collective action.
Rachel Dolezal is a human rights activist. She's the director of education at the Human Rights Education Institute in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Rachel also teaches at Eastern Washington University and North Idaho College. Heather Ebba Mabe recorded Rachel at a presentation she made in April 2010 at the University of Idaho campus for Human Rights Week. Music is Psych. It's by Mix Music D. You're listening to Yin Radio, and today our show is Mix It Up. Installment number two. Lisa Diamond is the author of Sexual Fluidity, Understanding Women's Love and Desire. It's published by Harvard Press. Laying the groundwork for the concept of sexual fluidity, chapter one is titled, Will a Real Lesbians Please Stand Up? Lisa's research into sexual identity and attractiveness and attractivity has led to some surprising results. It blasts some of the long-held concepts that people are either gay or straight. Maybe they're occasionally bisexual, but that's not really understood, or it's considered a latent or repressed inclination toward homosexuality. Lisa Diamond's nearly 20 years of research has shown that, especially for women, there is another story. Lisa Diamond began her work in sexual identity development as a graduate student in the early 1990s. During her keynote presentation at the Art of Gender Conference at Idaho State University in February 2010, where this installment of today's show was recorded, she started by describing the thinking about sexual identity at that time.
There was a sort of standard story that was often told about identity development that I like to call the sort of master narrative. And it was a narrative that was based largely on the experiences of men. Most of the research on identity development, and by identity development, I just mean, you know, the sort of classic, how did the gay person get to be kind of who they are? How did you begin to question your sexuality, come to accept it, come to disclose it to other people? And the way that most of the research was done was you took samples of adult, usually white, middle-class gay men, and you asked them to remember back to, you know, what they could remember about their process of sort of self-realization and self-discovery. And the stories were pretty sort of standard. Oh, as a child, I had these attractions. I didn't know kind of what to do about them. And then as I got older, I started to explore and blah, blah, blah. And there's nothing wrong with that story because it describes a lot of people really well. What I was concerned about was, A, that there weren't as many stories from women. And second, that when you did find stories from women, they didn't always follow that pattern, and that there were certain deviations that struck me as being sort of significant and worth exploring. One was that the timing was a lot more variable. So whereas men's stories would often describe their first sort of awareness of their sexuality in childhood or in like late childhood, 8 or 9 years of age, you would have some of those stories for women, but you'd also have some women saying, well, I didn't really realize anything until I was 25, until I was 30, until I was 40. So there was just a much broader range of timing among women than among men. And the sort of the standard explanation for that was, oh, well, these were women who were in denial, which was seemed to me to be sort of a pat, almost a too easy explanation, like, oh, they were just in denial for 40 years. Second, there were often a lot of discontinuities in women's experiences, that they would not only describe kind of a later awareness, but sometimes it would be after very long periods of strong heterosexual identification, like, I was happily married, and then I met Judith, you know, and everything changed. So there would be these sharp disjunctures instead of something like, well, I was married, but I was always really miserable, and I always knew it, that I was a lesbian. There were these twists and turns that were really abrupt and were not consistent with that master narrative. And finally, whereas a lot of the stories told by men really emphasized erotic feelings, and you know, I remember arousal, and I remember having wet dreams about men, women's stories often revolved around particular relationships, having met one woman who made them rethink what their sexuality was all about, and that the relational context appeared to be really important. So I was like, well, how do we know what these mean? And as a young and naive graduate student, I was like, I know. I'll just do this qualitative longitudinal study. I basically proposed to my advisor to do a study that I would never let any of my own graduate students do now. I would like slap them down in a minute. I was like, oh, I'm just going to find a lot of women, who are in the process of coming out, and I'll interview them. And then I'll just follow them over time and see what happens. And my advisor was like, well, do you want to finish your degree at some point? So he let me do the study. I actually, only the first wave was my master's thesis, and I didn't even do my dissertation on it, but I kept the study going. I started this study in 1995, and it's still going. And it really changed my whole way of thinking about sexuality, which is, I think, what good research can do is that, it's not only that the researcher has this idea and they want to put it out there, but I feel like I was really changed by doing this study, and so I want to sort of bring you along a little bit on the journey that it took me on. So the sample that I was working with, I was living, in Ithaca, New York, So I basically recruited 89 sexual minority women. By that I mean lesbian, bisexual, unlabeled but non-heterosexual, and then an additional 11 heterosexual women that I almost interviewed just for fun. I'm like, what would heterosexual women do if I gave them my interview? But I don't really include them in these data because they're sort of like a different group. So all of the women were between the ages of 16 and 23 back when I started the study in 1995. And I basically drove everywhere that I could get to in my car from Ithaca, New York, to recruit women. So Binghamton, Syracuse, Rochester, Freeville, basically if it was within like a 4-hour drive of Ithaca, I went there. And I went to LGBT youth groups, college courses on sexuality, pride parades, community centers, and just, you know, went up to young women and just, you know, like recruited them sort of one by one into the study. I wasn't really looking for a particular distribution, but it ended up that around 43% of the sample was lesbian, 30% bisexual, and 27% said that they were, you know, some version of queer something, but they didn't want to label their sexuality. They knew they weren't heterosexual, but they didn't want to claim a label. And I was pretty glad to have that many bisexual and unlabeled women in the sample, because at that point, if you looked at the research literature, and this is still true to a large extent, you would almost always find in any sort of method section, well, we had this many lesbians and this many, you know, bisexuals, and then like this number of people didn't identify. So we deleted the bisexuals. We deleted basically everybody who was not like a bona fide, like self-identified lesbian. The idea being, well, we don't really know what these other people are, right? They say they're bisexual, but who knows what that is? So they would just cut them right out of the sample. And this would happen in every single study. I'm like, wow, you know, that's a lot of people that are being basically systematically excluded from the literature. We don't really know anything about them. And so no wonder people are like, wow, does bisexuality exist? I'm like, well, of course it doesn't exist because you've taken it out, right? It's like, you know, foregone conclusion. So I was hoping that I would like by chance end up with some of them in the sample because I was curious as to what their trajectories would look like. And so I was really glad to get them in the sample. So there's been six assessments over that time and only 11% attrition, which I'm very proud of. And, you know, God knows, when I started this study, only 5 of the women had email addresses. These, if it were not for the internet, I, you know, like finding these women as they've moved from state to state and it's like 15 years and their addresses die. The internet has saved my life, man. I love the web. And basically, all of the data collection has been interviews. So the first wave of data collection was a face-to-face interview that lasted about an hour and a half, where I would ask women about the process through which they questioned their sexuality and came out, their most important sort of relationships, their patterns of sexual behavior. And then when I would do the follow-up interviews, they were over the phone because by that point, women were starting to move around. And I would just re-ask them the same questions over the years and, you know, sort of have them update me on where things were going. So probably the most sort of startling bit of data, but also one that I think summarizes in a lot of ways what I want to talk about when I talk about sexual fluidity, is simply what happened with sexual identity. And by sexual identity, I mean that, you know, I started the interview by saying, you know, how do you label your sexual identity to yourself, even if it's different from what you tell other people? And if you don't label it, you know, that's fine too. So lesbian, bisexual, unlabeled were the general categories. Every once in a while, someone would be like, well, you know, queer or dyke, but generally they fell into these categories. And what sort of happened over time ended up being rather interesting. And already at the first wave of data collection, some women said, well, I came out as something different than I currently identify as. And certainly in the identity literature, there was a lot of discussion over that initial identity label selection can sometimes be, you know, a period of questioning. So I wasn't too surprised by that. So basically, 19 of the lesbians said that they had come out as bisexual and then they switched to lesbian at some point. And then 7 of the bisexuals had initially identified, come out as lesbian and then switched to bisexual. I was like, okay, you know, no big deal. Pretty consistent with the literature. So then between time 1 and time 2, about 13 of the unlabeled women switched identity. So 6 of the unlabeled women transitioned to identifying as bisexual by time two, and then seven of the unlabeled women switched to identifying as lesbian at time two. I'm like, oh, well, that sort of makes sense with this like progressive, you know, they moved from an unlabeled state to a labeled state. That sort of makes a lot of sense. What I didn't expect was that three of the lesbians switched to bisexual from time one and time two, and three unlabeled themselves, right? Which is like, according to the identity development literature, that's like retrograde. You're not supposed to label and then unlabel. And they weren't saying that they were no longer, you know, queer in some way. They were just like, oh, I don't feel like that label kind of fits me anymore. I was like, okay. Among the bisexuals, three bisexuals graduated to lesbianism, and two unlabeled themselves. And then, horror of horrors, oh my God, say it ain't so. We had five women who actually re-identified as heterosexual, even though they were like, well, I'm still attracted to women, but I identify as heterosexual now. I'm like, okay. So all together, that it was like a third of the sample. A third of the sample changed their identities in that two-year period between time one and time two. And I thought, well, you know, they're still relatively young. You could argue that they were still in an early stage of the questioning process, and they were still sort of resolving it. So now we're at time two, and between time two and time three, we had more of the same. Three more lesbians identified as bisexual. Three more went down to that unlabeled category. Here were the bisexual women. They're all over the map. One moved to lesbian, three to unlabeled, six transitioned to heterosexual. Then three of those new heterosexuals went back to being queer again. They went back into an unlabeled category. One unlabeled woman went to the lesbian category. So altogether, it was 24% of women changed. So the next wave of data collection, you know, we're now like 5 years out, or between year five and year eight. Here we go. One lesbian switches to bisexual, five to unlabeled. Here are the bisexual women. Here are the unlabeled women, three more then we have the heterosexual women unheterosexualifying themselves. 31% change. And by the way, these are not the same women each time. There was actually a relatively small number of women who changed more than once. So most of these transitions are one-time only transitions. So here we have time four to time five. And you know, at this point, I wasn't even surprised. I'm like, God, you know, it's just crazy. 28% have changed. I mean, altogether, since the first wave of data collection, two-thirds of women changed their identity from time one. And if I count those transitions that occurred before time one, it's actually up to 75%. And 50% of those changes involved giving up a lesbian or bisexual label for an unlabeled or a heterosexual identity, right? So this sort of like unidentification, which is not supposed to happen. 17% of women readopted a heterosexual label at some point, although many of them jumped right back out of it again because by time five, only 9% were currently identifying as heterosexual, and all of them claimed that they were still attracted to women. And this is the really interesting thing. At each wave, when a woman would report that she changed her identity label and I would ask her why, they never said, oh, I was wrong before. You know, that I thought that was my identity, but I was wrong. They did not describe it as this like, oh, there's a true self and a false self, and I had a false self, and now this is my true self. It was, well, you know, that was where I was right at that time, but there's a lot has changed. I'm with a different person. I'm in a different place in my life. That it was described as a sort of authentic emergence of a new sense of self, and not this like, oh, I was repressed, and then I unrepressed myself. Which raises this question, though, of what exactly then is motivating the changes? What's changing when identity changes? And where is orientation in all this? You know, what's happening with women's actual pattern of attractions? So let me show you what I found with their attractions. Because at each wave of data collection, I asked them to sort of give a number between 0 and 100, representing sort of the percentage of their day-to-day physical attractions that were directed toward women versus men. So that 100% would be only women, 0% would be only men, and then there's 50-50, 60-40, you know, whatever. So it's sort of like an approximation of the Kinsey scale, except in sort of percentages, because it's sort of easier to understand. And so I'm going to show you the percentage of same-sex attractions at each wave. And this is basically what you found, which are not really significant changes. You see the lines, they move a little bit, but they're not moving a heck of a lot. And actually, none of these groups significantly changed their patterns of attraction over time. What ended up being more interesting was the variability within each of the groups, right? Because I'm just showing you means, average levels within each group. If you look at the standard deviations, which for those of you who are not statistically inclined, represent how much variability there was within each of these groups, what you find looks like this. In other words, there's a lot of crossover between the groups in terms of some lesbians saying I'm 70% attracted to women and some bisexuals saying, well, I'm 80. It's like you can even not even really have a difference between the group if there's that much variability. So at least at time one, you see a sort of some meaningful distinction between the groups that most of the lesbians report being between 80 and 100% attracted to women, and most of the bisexual and unlabeled women report sort of a range that is below that. But by the time you get to time five, there's total crossover between those groups, suggesting to me that women are taking a pattern of experiences and behavior and defining it in different ways. That two women could have exactly the same pattern of attractions. One of them could say, well, I call that lesbian. And another woman would say, well, for me, I call that bisexual. So that there was a variability, and women were defining it in very different ways. So this raised the question for me over and over as every year went by, is there something that will predict whether a woman's going to change her identity or not? Is there something that will tell us why some women are going through these changes and some women are not? And so over the years, I basically tested every lay theory that I had, and almost all of them were completely wrong. One of them was age. I'm like, maybe the younger women are more variable. It seems like a reasonable sort of developmental hypothesis, like immaturity, blah, blah, blah. Age never predicted anything. It just was a complete bust. So the younger women weren't changing, and as the years went by and women got older, they weren't less likely to change. So age completely failed to predict. Developmental milestones. I have a real beef with developmental milestones. So by this I mean things like age of first same-sex attraction, age of first same-sex behavior, age of first disclosure of sexual identity. And I tested those because in the sexual identity literature, you find those things discussed all the time. It seems important. It's like, when did you first, blah, 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 blah. It sort of seems intuitively important, but if you actually look at the research literature, no one has any theory as to why that should matter about anything. And no one has ever stated anything like early awareness means. It's just like, it must mean something, right? So A, there's no theory at all as to why it matters. And there's certainly nothing in the sort of conventional sexual development literature for garden variety heterosexuals that talks about age of first anything. The other reason that I started to get more and more annoyed at the milestone data, it's some of the worst, methodologically, it's some of the worst data that you can imagine. I mean, think right now, if I say to you, okay, remember your earliest sexual attraction, maybe you can come up with something, but the likelihood that actually is the first erotic attraction that you had is really low. I mean, you're talking about remembering back, I don't know how many years, and we know that memory is so completely reconstructed that by saying, okay, think back to when your first same-sex attraction was, we have no evidence that that is anything other than junk data, that the memory is just so bad for something like that. So, I would collect this data from my own participants, and I'd be like, I don't even know what kind of, what they're remembering. So I wasn't really surprised that it didn't predict identity change, because there's really no reason it ought to, predict, anything. I think memories for first same-sex behavior are more reliable, but memories for first same-sex attraction are crazy. The other thing that bothers me about the first same-sex attraction data that people collect is I would find, after women gave me an age, it was when I was 6, and I would say, describe what it was. There was incredible variability in the types of experiences people were reporting. One woman would say that her first same-sex attraction was seeing other little girls naked and wanting to touch them. Another would be I was with my friend and I was braiding her hair and I felt really close to her. So there was incredible diversity of experience, which led me to believe, like, you know, we could be comparing apples and oranges. I don't know what, you know, what we're talking about. So whenever you read any article that reports first age of first same-sex attractions, you should have like a real skeptical, you know, you should hold that article at a distance. Context of questioning. So some of the women in my study, you know, I would ask them, you know, how they first started to question their sexuality, and some would be like, oh, you know, I knew I was attracted to this girl, and we kissed, and it was great. And for other women, it would be this completely intellectual experience, like they read about lesbians or bisexual women, and so they thought about it, wondered whether it applied to themselves. So I looked at whether women who questioned through a more kind of ideological or cognitive route were more likely to change their identity than women who came out in a more kind of sexual way. Didn't predict at all. No prediction at all. Experienced ideology. By that I mean women who, when I said, I would ask them, do you feel like you were born with your sexuality? Do you feel like chance or choice or anything like that had some role to play? And most women didn't feel like choice had much of a role to play. Some women felt that circumstance did. They're like, well, maybe if I hadn't met that woman at that time, I don't know what would have happened. And then someone were like, no, I totally feel like it's something biological that I was born this way. Women's own sense of how they got to be the way they are had no relationship to identity change at all. Then I started trying personality traits. I'm like, maybe these women are neurotic, right? Maybe that's why they're changing. No relationship to personality traits, no relationship to neuroticism, extroversion, agreeableness, any of the major personality traits. Family attitudes, whether your family was accepting or not accepting, whether your family was conservative or liberal, that didn't predict anything. Women's own experiences of stigma and harassment, whether they'd been harassed, whether they were living in an environment that was less accepting, that didn't predict. So what was associated with identity change? The number one thing, the most important thing, was the degree to which women's attractions were what I call non-exclusive, or another word for that would be bisexual. But I don't use bisexual to describe attractions because it's also an identity label and that gets kind of confusing. What I mean is having attractions that are not 100% women or 0% women, but in that middle range. Women that had attractions to both men and women were more likely to change their identities over time. And one example of this is that 2/3 of the identity transitions that women undertook involved adopting a bisexual label or adopting an unlabeled identity. And often the adoption of the unlabeled identity was adopting a label that would permit either attractions or relationships with men or with women because it sort of left it kind of open. The reason I think this is so interesting is because of the degree to which the sort of standard view for many years has been that women with non-exclusive attractions are weird. They're unusual. The standard view for many years was that the prototypical gay person, whether male or female, was 100%, you know, gay, 100% lesbian, and that bisexuals were in transition, or they were confused, or at the very least, there weren't that many of them. So, you know, that's why you can delete them from the research sample, because it was a sort of strange and exceptional little population and nobody needed to worry about it. What's interesting is that we now know from a lot of good representative data that not only was that not true, it's like so completely in the opposite direction of true that it leads me to sort of, you know, have a lot of doubt about a lot of the data that's been collected over the last 20 years. So I'm going to show you some data that was actually collected from a sociologist, and this is a random representative sample of American adults. So this is gold standard data. Like, these people were not recruited on the basis of being gay. This was basically a study that sampled thousands of adults and asked them about their pattern of sexual attraction. You know, and I took off the people who said that they were only attracted to the opposite sex, you know, heterosexuals, because they would blow up, you know, they are the vast majority of Americans. So I'm just showing you the folks that said that they were attracted to the same sex at all. So the four categories we have are, you know, mostly attracted to the other sex, attracted to both sexes, mostly attracted to the same sex, are only attracted to the same sex, right? And the only same-sex category is the one that for years everyone has been assuming is the main category. And in fact, what you find is that the biggest category is this one. Folks who say that they're mostly attracted to the other sex, but not completely. They're like not complete heterosexuals. They're just sort of leaning heterosexual. Here's the both sexes category, much smaller. Here's the mostly same-sex category. And get ready for the big gender difference here. There's the only same-sex category. So as you'll see, in men, that group is pretty much as big as the mostly other sex category. For women, that's the smallest group. It's the smallest group of all. So even though we've been assuming that lesbians are prototypical and that women that have bisexual patterns of attraction are atypical, women who are exclusively attracted to the same sex are actually the smallest, and you could argue the least representative, you know, sort of proportion of the population of women who have same-sex attractions to begin with. And again, that gender difference, I think, is really notable. And this is the cropped up again and again in other studies, suggesting that there is a real gender difference in the sort of pattern of exclusivity, that there are more men who are exclusively gay than there are women who are exclusively lesbian, and that there are more bisexual women than there are bisexual men, which is why I think it's interesting to consider how that gender difference has influenced the models that we've built about sexuality. We've basically developed models of sexual orientation that have been based on men's experiences, which is a part of why bisexuality has been so under-investigated over the years. So here's some data that's collected in Australia. And the same basic thing, but they use the Kinsey scale. So basically, on the Kinsey scale, a 6 would be exclusively attracted to the same sex. 0 would be exclusively heterosexual. So again, I took them off. 1 would be like that mostly opposite sex, but not completely category. And then 3 and 4 in the middle. So this was the distribution. Again, this is random representative data. So these are men, right? See the same sort of pattern, a spike at 1 and then a spike at 6 and then smaller numbers in between. Here are women. Same pattern we saw in the United States data. Huge spike at 1. It gets progressively smaller and smaller and smaller as you go along. So again, the exclusive lesbians are actually the smallest group in the study. And again, that gender difference is really, really striking. And here's some more recent data collected in the United States. Again, this is, I think, from the Centers for Disease Control. Same thing. Look at the huge spike of mostly other sex attracted women. And then you see smaller groups all along. There's the only same-sex category, again, smaller in women. And then here's my favorite thing. They actually had a not sure category. And again, these are the kind of people who would totally be deleted from research samples in years past. But look for women. There are more women who are not sure than who are saying that they're exclusively attracted to the same sex. So, I mean, if you think about the fact that historically we've only been collecting data from openly identified lesbians and gay men, for both women and men, you can see that we've been deleting almost everybody from these graphs. That group of folks that we've been collecting data on is a really small number of people, showing that we have a picture of the phenomenon of same-sex sexuality that's distorted, that doesn't show the full range of people that we should be interested in talking about. Now, the other thing that I think was relevant is that if you are someone who has the capacity to be attracted to men or women, then, you know, the relationship that you're in that moment could potentially be very influential in how you identify your sexuality. And that was exactly what I found, was that often when women would change their identity labels, it would be because they were in a relationship and they would label on the basis of that relationship. So like, well, I'm 60-40 attracted to women, but I'm with a woman right now. So I'm identifying as lesbian because I'm with a woman. Or opposite case, like I'm attracted to both women and men, but I happen to be with a man. So I might as well identify as heterosexual because, like, for functional purposes, I sort of am. And this was really evident when I looked at the patterns of women's attractions and relationships over time. So if I lay out the whole sample in terms of their distribution of attractions, the majority of the sample were mainly attracted to women, and then they were sort of spread throughout. And that general distribution stayed the same over time. It didn't really change that much. Now, their behavior was very different. When I looked at the percentage of their sexual behavior that was with women versus men over the years, you see something very different. It starts to basically get more and more polarized, right? So I like to call this like sexual suburbia, that even if their attractions were non-exclusive, as they settled down, as time went on, their behavior basically became nearly 100% with women or nearly 100% with men. So there was a disjuncture between these pretty variable attractions and then this pretty stable pattern of behavior, which I think, you know, is basically what happens when you find one person and you develop a monogamous relationship. The majority of women, by the time they were in time five, were in stable long-term relationships with someone that they were monogamous with. So they would be like, well, you know, I could, you know, be with both, but right now 100% of my behavior is with this one gender and with this one partner. The other thing that related to identity change was this phenomenon that some women describe when they said, you know, when I'm attracted to someone, I'm not really thinking about their gender. I'm attracted to the person. I get a thing for a person, and the packaging that that person is in is not really relevant to me. And what I found was interesting was that although women, you know, often describe this to me, you know, starting at time one, as the years went by, they became less willing to take that experience and label it. They'd be like, there is no label for that. You know, they're like, lesbian doesn't describe it, bisexual doesn't describe it, like a person-centered sexuality is what I have, and there's no word that can capture that, and I don't want to sort of, you know, distort my experience by putting some sort of term on it. And what was interesting is that these sorts of, and so they would often be like, you know, and so with the person that I'm with, it wasn't that she was a man or a woman, it was that it was her. I fell in love with her, and that was what was so important. What I think is so interesting about this is that stories like this, if you look at the sexual identity literature, emerged over and over. You can find a lot of narratives that sound like this. But over the years, I found that both researchers and also just, you know, kind of lay people are skeptical of those stories. They're like, oh, yeah, right, it's just her, you know, like, oh, that's what the story that everybody tells themselves if they're afraid to come out, right? Oh, you know, I'm not attracted to all women, I'm just attracted, you know, to Amy. And the standard theory is that that's not possible. It's like the Lay's potato chip theory of same-sex attraction. Like, bet you can't have just one, right? And so if you had one person, you had to have this capacity to be attracted to all women. But what I found in my own research is that over the years, you know, women would not end up sort of distancing themselves from that story. Like, because if it was true that that was just a denial narrative, then you would expect that as the years went by, they'd be like, okay, I guess it wasn't just Amy. I guess I was really hot for all women. But that was not, in fact, what happened. Those women often would settle down with that woman and be like, well, I'm still only really attracted to her, but it's great because, like, she's my wife and, like, you know, we're together. So I think that we, over the years, we had sort of discounted this notion of having a sexuality that could be based around one person. But over the years, I found that that really does describe how some women experience their attractions. So this was what sort of led me to try and come up with a way of representing women's sexuality that was not based on the old kind of rigid male models, and that did a better job of accounting for this sort of variability. And so that's where I sort of came up with the notion of sexual fluidity, which I describe as a sort of capacity for a more flexible erotic response, one that can sometimes depend on the particular person that you're with, that can be triggered by situational factors, you know, with someone being like, you know, maybe if I had not been in this environment, I wouldn't have come out in the same way. And what I think is really important here is that I'm not saying that sexual fluidity is something to sort of replace the old model of sexual orientation. I absolutely think sexual orientation exists. What I think is probably more accurate is that women have a sexual orientation. It could be predominantly lesbian, it could be bisexual, otherwise it could be heterosexual, but there's also this variable capacity for fluidity. that some women, you know, regardless of their sexual orientation, have some sort of wiggle room around that orientation, that given the right person and the right situation, they may be able to experience erotic and affectional feelings that contradict their orientation in some really powerful ways. Importantly, I don't think that all women are equally fluid. There are women in my sample who are as stable, as consistently lesbian as one can get. That they were 100% attracted to women at time one, they were 100% attracted to women at time two, time three, time four, time five. I don't know why you keep asking me these questions. You know, nothing's changed. So I don't think that fluidity affects all women equally. I think some women have more of a capacity for it than others. And that's why I like to think of it as sort of a separate dimension, so that you can think about every woman as having an orientation and then having this separate individual difference variable of just how fluid she is or is not, and that you can't really understand or predict what her life is going to hold without kind of taking both of those phenomena into account.
That was Dr. Lisa Diamond. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Utah. Lisa Diamond shared her work with Yin Radio during her keynote presentation at Idaho State University's Art of Gender Conference in February 2010. Lisa's studies of sexual identity development are changing the way researchers and the rest of us view sexual orientation. Her work has been featured in the New York Times, and she's appeared on Oprah, among other places. Lisa Diamond's book is called Sexual Fluidity: Understanding Women's Love and Desire, and it's published by Harvard Press. This is Yin Radio, and our theme is Mix It Up. Sometimes you need tools if you want to mix it up. I use a blender. Last summer, I was on a yogurt strawberry shake kick. I made one every day. The strawberry harvest had been super, and I still have a bunch in the freezer. They are the key for a great breakfast drink. It takes a handful of frozen strawberries, some plain, preferably sour yogurt, a banana, and enough milk to make it thin enough to drink. Blend it up, and voila! You have a healthy, tasty, transportable breakfast drink. I had to know what other people mix up in a blender, so I asked a few around town.
What's your favorite thing to make in a blender?
Ooh, margaritas. But I also like pesto. Sometimes I'll do pesto in a blender, even though it's not as delicious as in not blender.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was easier. That was easy.
What's your favorite thing to make in a blender?
Bicycle blended berry blasts.
Oh, good answer. I should have known. What's your favorite thing to make in a blender?
Oh, you don't want to know.
Is it gross?
Well, actually, you know what? I haven't blended anything for a while, except maybe pastry dough. I do it by hand in a blender. Yeah. Well, okay, Cuisinart. Okay. Maybe that's not quite the
same. That's close enough. Yeah. Works for me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Now that I've had time to reflect a little bit, I think that strawberry smoothies, is probably my favorite thing to make in a blender.
More than margaritas.
I mean, they both have a time and place. One's for breakfast and one's for dinner.
Which one?
Depending on the day.
What's your favorite thing to make in a blender?
My favorite thing to make in a blender? Crepes.
Crepes in a blender?
Crepes in a blender.
You don't have to tell me.
That's what all of my recipes are. You make crepes in a blender. You put all the ingredients in, and you blend it, and then you put it in the refrigerator for 2 hours, and you make the best crepes ever.
Like what kind?
Sweet crepes. Breakfast crepes.
Strawberry?
No, just plain crepe batter.
Oh, you make the batter itself.
Yeah.
I was thinking of the filling.
Yes, I do that too.
Okay.
I make banana filling, mushed up bananas and sugar and milk.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
What's your favorite thing to make in a blender?
dog meat cake. No, dog meat, not dog meat. Beef cake. It made me all nervous.
I know. That's okay. You can try it again. The right way.
Beef cake.
Now you have to explain this, of course.
Ground up beef and egg, and then bake a cake for dogs.
I'll ask you both, what's your favorite thing to make in a blender?
Raspberry ice cream sauce.
That's good.
I haven't used a blender in 20 years, but when I did, I took frozen raspberries and blended them up for raspberry sauce.
See? That'll be a good one. Raspberries in the blender.
Strawberry banana smoothie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, what do you put in yours?
Ice cream and ice. Milk. Sometimes milk.
Strawberry ice cream or strawberries?
Strawberries.
Cool. What do you like to make in a blender?
Milkshake.
What kind?
Vanilla.
My boyfriend had a broken jaw. I had to.
What did you do when your boyfriend broke his jaw?
I had to blend up chili in a blender through a straw.
Ew. It sounds gross.
I know. It's disgusting. That and mashed potatoes.
Through a straw.
Yep.
Might get a little plugged.
With the chili and the mashed potatoes.
A big straw?
No, a little straw. It had to go in between his teeth. That was bad.
What's your favorite thing to make in a blender?
Smoothies.
What kind of smoothies do you like?
Berries. Any berries.
And what do you put in yours?
Orange sherbet, yogurt, and any berries I can get a handle on.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
What's your favorite thing to make in a blender?
My favorite thing to make, I don't really have anything inventive to make in a blender. The only things I really ever make are, smoothies, soups, and pesto. So I would say my favorite thing that I've ever made was a red pepper soup. Mm. It was very good.
Had garlic.
With garlic? I don't know. I don't remember. It was a very long time ago. Another one, that other one, though, that winter tomato soup that I made that you really liked that I didn't like so much, but I grew to like after I had made it and had it a couple times. But as far as fun, I don't really, my favorite, there's nothing like that stands out tremendously. I really, really like sort of hearty, smooth soups, so, I mean, you need a blender for that. That's pretty much it.
And that's pretty much it for this Yin Radio show. Thanks for mixing it up with me. I'm going to end the show by sharing a mix by Ms. Filter. She's also known as Hadley. And the song reflects on a mix of weather. It's called Sunshine from Rain.
Everyone out.
can catch past shows and podcasts at www.yinradio.org. Yinradio.org is also where you can sign up to receive updates about the program or make a contribution to support Yin Radio. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation and me. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. I'm glad you could join me. Until next week.